This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 25th of October, 1962. The title of this lecture is 3GA Crisscross Data. This tape is 67 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
Thank you. It has become damp. The English weather has turned into unusual California weather. I used to have a secretary while I was working down in Hollywood for films. The studio would send her over every morning, route me out. She'd come in, she'd open up the blinds, she'd look outside. She'd say, "My, what unusual weather." See? This kept up for about 2 months. One day she came in, and she opened up the blinds, and she looked out, and before she could speak, I said, "My, what unusual weather." She applied for a transfer to some other writer. I'll tell you that story. Susie isn't here yet. Anyway, this is the what of what? 25 oct AD 12. This is the month with the thermonuclear in it. Well, this first lecture here is an experimental approach to 3GA crisscross and accumulated data on 3GA crisscross. And I have awfully, awfully, awfully good news for you. I have made a breakthrough, I think, which you will find very, very interesting. And if this works out uniformly, which I have no reason to believe that it will not, it will be a simple method of an assessment on a couple of lists, and you will have your first item with a crash on the PC. That's interesting, isn't it? I don't know why you should be so lucky as to have me around, but there it is. Now, the rock slam was called the rock slam because it was obvious that the first item on the PC's track was an item with which the PC had a very large confusion. It was the first thing that he used to help with or to get help with or something of this sort. And it was called the rock. And it's actually, original definition, I believe, was the first mass that he attributed large significances to. Now, we were clearing people by merely clearing out of the road the rock. Now, that was done exclusively with help processes on about a five-way bracket. And we did make some clears, people that went free needle and proper point on the tone arm and felt wonderful and so forth, just by this process of assessment for the rock. Now, I noticed in doing the research work on this that the road to the rock was accompanied with a very peculiar agitation of the needle. And no other word or name had been given this agitation of the needle, which went left and right and back and forth and so forth. And I gave it the term rock slam, because it's certainly a slamming needle. It's going to the left and to the right and back and forth in a high degree of agitation. Now, that phenomenon is an extremely basic phenomenon in clearing. And as you can realize, the number of stable clears that were made in earlier years must therefore be very close to zero. We've made the temporary clears lots of times. People have hung on quite a while and all that sort of thing. But stable clears, no. you see. And that is our target, somebody who will simply get that way and stay that way along the line. Well, now, obviously, a person who was a rock clear, that is, you could get down to their rock and blow their rock, still wouldn't have knocked off all of the GPM, because underlying that rock was the goal. And between that first day, that ACC in which that was taught, was that the 20th?
Yeah.
The 20th ACC, and sometime just before, it was about the time of the South African Congress, I integrated goal as the underlying thing below the rock. Now, this broadened out clearing considerably. You see, now you have a whole channel of pertinent terminals, various kinds, things that the PC has been, and then this goes down to the earliest beenness, which is the rock. See? But underlying the rock, we find the goal. You get what the anatomy is. You could draw yourself a little channel here very, very easily, and you would see exactly what we are looking at here. And these data have been very hard to come by the way. Here was the way it might be said to be. There's the rock at the bottom here. And then here's the goal. Now you see that. There's some sort of a channel of livingness which comes down this long line and gets to the rock, and there's the goal. All right. Now, the goal then lies earlier than the rock. But the rock is the first big mass that occurs after this fact. And of course, up this channel of livingness, we have all sorts of small valences, you see, or repeating valences. And what I didn't know at that time, and which I found out about the middle of last year, is you actually have two valences like this. One whose force is that direction, and one whose force is against it in that direction. It looks like a dumbbell. Every once in a while, PCs run into these things, and they say, "Ron, how did you know?" Well, I looked. And anyway, this thing is the basic unit anatomy of the GPM. You have mass A versus mass B, and they are impinged on each other, and one is a terminal and one is an opterm, referring you to last Tuesday night's lectures. Therefore, the rock must have another rock. Get the idea? The rock's got another rock. Now, you have to ask this question about the GPM, see? How come it stays in place? How come it stays in place? How come it stays suspended in space, in time? How come it stays with you? Well, it must be very carefully balanced against an opposing force. And hence we get this word, goal's problem mass, heard a relatively few months ago, last autumn, I think. Why goal's problem mass? Well, it is that mass which results in the problem of the terminal versus the opterm as a result of the PC having postulated a goal. Now, this interesting proposition could be offered. And we could say that's how it hangs up so delicately in space. I worked this out synthetically, you know, just on asking this one question of how the devil does it stay there, you know? And it has to be opposing forces which are in balance with it for the thing to stay in place. So we have these two dumbbells, one against the other, repeated many times in the bank, but each one of them held in very, very critical balance. The one thing that is missing in Newton's laws, in the field of physics, that no physics professor, and I think there must be hundreds of thousands of them lecturing on physics throughout the world, has ever seemed to have noticed. There's the law of comparable magnitude. And they violate this. They know the data is incomparable all the time. And they give you such an idiocy that when you stamp on the earth moves back to the degree that you move down, you know, in relative mass. Yeah. Well, you know, I've gotten out there and taken a look, you know, and it doesn't. Now we have the comparable magnitude of the overt. You consider it no overt to swat a fly. Yet flies swat you through disease and other vias once in a blue moon. But you don't consider that a return of the overt. I don't think it's much of a terminal opterm situation you swatting a fly. You see, the law of comparable magnitudes is violated. Now, Newton's three laws are only valid in the zone of comparable magnitude. For every action, there is an equal and contrary reaction. Well, that isn't necessarily violated because it does say equal, but that in itself is the assumption of an absolute, which makes the law a little bit questionable. But there's the law of acceleration. There's the law of inertia, the tendency of a body to remain at a state of rest, to remain in state of motion, don't you see? All these things are true unless you get forces which are too different, too far apart. You get the idea. Inertia, the tendency of a body to remain in a state of rest. Well, I think actually when a cannonball hits a palm tree splinter, I don't think the palm tree splinter has any law of inertia. Get the idea? I mean, it has no tendency at all to remain in a state of rest. It'd be utterly unmeasurable, and it becomes idiotic. Drop the Empire State Building on a fly. You see, and then say the fly had a tendency to remain in a state of rest. These things become ridiculous, don't you see? Now, the size of the basic rock, op rock, is pretty darn big. And these things versus one another contain rather interestingly strong forces. Very strong forces. And they're studded and pushed in against, and everything is smashed up together, of smaller pairs of these dumbbells. And there are smaller pairs of dumbbells and smaller pairs of dumbbells. And the further the theta progresses in time from the moment of the assumption of the rock, then the less force or mass he has to have to consider it force or mass. His consideration of what is force and what is mass deteriorates. So you get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller dumbbells. See, they go from... Well, you've seen somebody around, and you've swatted him on the back, you know, in a friendly gesture. You've patted him on the back, you know, just about hardly even that, you know. And he says, "Oh God, I've broken my ribs," you know. Well, a slice of carrot versus a slice of cabbage would appear to him to be insurmountably great and powerful. You get the idea of the size of the dumbbell. It's declined. His conception of his own force, his ability to handle force and so forth, and mass has deteriorated. And it's deteriorated down to a point where the dumbbell at the top of this, if we consider that now, is almost microscopically small, one versus the other. And then as we progress down from the top toward this rock, we get bigger and bigger dumbbells, A versus B, as you see, till we get down to the rock versus the op rock, and we've got it. See, that's big. Now, that tells you at once why, when you say to somebody, all right, that's your goal, well, why don't you just change your mind? See, that's approaching clearing on a no gradient. And he can't do it. Why can't he do it? Because his concept of force in the vicinity of the time he postulated this goal envisioned something being pretty forceful before he would call it force. And now, hey, he lets out a gentle sigh and thinks he is blowing a furnace blast, you see? So he can't face that much force. See, he can't face as much force at once as is contained in the rock, op rock area, which is much earlier in time. Do you follow that? So you say to him, all right, blow the GPM, thank you. Well, I guess you failed, huh? Why can't he blow the GPM just like that? Well, it's a decline of force is the story. As the eons have marched on, his concept of what is force has degenerated. In other words, he doesn't consider that forceful. He doesn't consider... Once upon a time, he considered motion with an exclamation point, you see. Well, that'd be something on the order of a meteorite hitting a spaceship, he'd say. Pretty good, you know. And now he dents the left fender of his car slightly, you see, and he goes, oh, my God, you know. That's too much force, you see. So the reason he doesn't blow his goal instantly and at once is a very simple reason. The goal lies before and earlier than a higher idea of force. And he gets into that zone and he can't tolerate that much force in that much area, so he cannot confront it. He can't confront that much force. It's too much for me, he says. Now, you might be able to get the forces of this lifetime and audit them very easily, but as soon as you start chipping back about 5 or 6 lifetimes, you start running into this phenomena. You know? I remember my idea of a good way to warm up was to take a horse like a Percheron, you know, and take 98 or 110 pounds worth of armor and take about a 15-foot-long ash spear and go out in the lists someplace, you know, and get this horse up to about 30 miles an hour, you know, and let him run head-on into another guy coming down the course in the other direction was 30 miles an hour, you know. That was a nice, quiet way to warm up. Now, the reason why it was spectacular is the people in the grandstand considered that too much force for them. And the reason one was successful at it is it did not exceed his idea of what was forceful. That didn't look like all that much impact to him. Why do you stop such a thing? Well, after a few centuries of monkeying around this way, pick yourself up off the ground and pick the hardware off of yourself, you see, and your head is ringing, you know, and you say, you know, I'm just not the man I was once. I think I'll take up judging these things, you see. You said that's too much force for me, you see. Once upon a time, this was almost a gag. See, just that much foot-pounds of impact. Well, it was just a good way to warm up, you know. You know, it made you feel kind of alive. And you deteriorate in your concept of the same thing of, good God, you know, how can they stand up to it? Similarly, racing. At this time, on this planet, you have many of these ideas in re-stimulation and so forth. You've got racing. It's always coming as a surprise to somebody that he can't stand up to as much force as he thought he could. A car hits a brick wall or something like this, and he gets his wind knocked out, and fenders get dented and so forth. He hasn't conceived there was that much force. Well, how does his idea that isn't very fatal, permit him to go into a race where that could be very fatal? Well, it's his misconceptions of the thing. He's measuring track by an earlier track idea. You follow this? Now, in the Markab Confederacy, a racing car was a turbine-driven job, and they went on for thousands of years. I think there was 10 or 12,000 years. They always had the same race cars, same races, everything. They didn't believe in progress. And they went about 275 miles an hour, according to our present standards. They went at a high whine. And they used to have casualties. Those things that go into a brick wall or one of the concrete ramparts or something like that. And they'd have a casualty. They'd have to take the pilot out and take him to the hospital tent. See, take the driver out of that and take him to the hospital tent to patch him up. Now, that is within the last 40,000 years. You get how rapidly one's concept of mass can deteriorate. Because I mention that because some of you got Markab on your tracks. A lot of you people run into bits and pieces of the racetracks of Markham. Well, take a look at it, at how much force. You see, 275 miles an hour in a turbine-driven car hitting a concrete wall and having to go to the hospital tent. 110 miles an hour caroming off of a brick wall or a fence and getting buried. Different ideas. See, it's a deterioration of the idea of force. Now, that doesn't say that the Thetan sometimes miraculously suddenly can't regain his older ideas of how much force he can tolerate. But it does say that on the average, there's a general deterioration. So when you ask a Thetan to go on the earliest track, find his goal, be right there at the point of his goal, all right, now you see that, now just change your mind, thank you, and it blows the whole bank. You see why that doesn't work. See, you've asked him to go and climb into a 500-mile-an-hour racing car, hit a concrete wall, and live. That's the way it looks to him. He says, what? Oh, you silly. You must think I'm stupid. Well, at the time he made up this thing, it had been something on the order, if you went at the speed of a meteor and you hit an asteroid, well, that was a good way to acquire mass. See, about the time he was making this goal up, that was his idea of mass, you know, impact, force, way up there. Well, you want to know what you're up against in clearing somebody. You're up against their concept of mass and force relative to their experiences and bad experiences. And there isn't even any name for this. We have randomity. It's plus or minus motion can be tolerated by the individual. And it comes under the heading of randomity, but it would also be an extension of this thing called randomity. It would be plus or minus force the individual could tolerate and plus or minus mass. How much mass is mass? And early on the track, he said, oh, well, that's pretty good-sized mass there. And he points to a big planet. Yeah, that's a nice piece of mist, you know. That's nice. Just about my size. And we find this same Thetan late on the track, and she can handle a bonbon very well. Say, what's your idea of mass? And the person says, that bonbon, that's very nice piece of mass. Or a diamond ring. Very nice mass. Now, if you don't think people's ideas of mass deteriorate rather rapidly, you should look at the disappearance of solid coinery in the bigger denominations. Gold pieces, that sort of thing. That isn't all. It isn't just the scarcity of gold. Somebody could dreamed up something to solve this, I'm sure. But it's another thing. It's another thing. Do you know that they used to make silver pieces in very outrageously large sizes? I saw one time I was stepped off the plane to get a breather, I think, in Salisbury. And somebody at the lunch counter was fooling around, I think, with a 5-shilling
Coin. Well, it was an interesting looking coin. It was a monstrous coin. It was very thick, and it was very soft, and it was solid silver, and it was way back from the old days when they used to dig it out of a vein down there and throw it in the mold and hope it was legal tender, you know. But that was, at one time, a nice... Well, that was money. It was valuable. It could buy something. Well, obviously, it's too much mass now. That's obviously too much coin, because that coin, although 5 shillings doesn't buy now anything what it bought then, why, the people take 2 much smaller coins to make up that 5 shilling by preference, don't you see? You get the deterioration of the monetary idea. Well, you can see this almost any place around. There's some signs of this thing. Now, what's this add up to? It adds up to why you can't immediately, rapidly, and right now clear somebody, and why some cases clear easily and some cases clear hard. And this is the answer to that. I can guarantee this to you now. That is the answer to anything else. This case has a very, still got a very massy idea of mass, you know. You know, he said, well, you know, nice piece of mass, you know, a mountain. Well, he clears pretty easily, see? But this next case says, well, nice piece of mass. Take that dirty coin out of here. He's inverted on the idea of mass. Can't look at it. Doesn't want to have anything to do with it. Also, it might surprise you, if you haven't thought of it, that the idea of pain as an undesirable commodity... Pain is an undesirable commodity is a late idea. Pain is not uniformly an undesirable commodity on the whole track. It is simply another sensation. Now, pain tends to increase as an unwanted, feared, and undesirable thing as one's concept of mass and force deteriorates. There's a direct relationship between these two things. Well, let me state this properly mathematically. It's an inverse relation. So the more a person fears pain and shudders away from pain, why, the less mass and force he can tolerate. In other words, this idea of pain. Pain is basically a sensation of impact. That's basically what it is. You seldom have pain without having some separation of impact or collision of impact or something like that. Pain is most normally in this line. Although pain is a heat, cold, electrical sensation. It is that with which force begins to be greeted as the individual's idea of force deteriorates. Well, let's take in one lifetime. The age of 16, fast enough, is 90 miles an hour. He considers that's pretty good. 90 miles an hour, that's fine with him. The age of 25, 55, 60, that is fast enough, and that's fine with him. 35 on, 40. That's pretty fast. That's fast enough. And about the age of 70, you get the character who causes all the accidents by going down the middle of the road at 15. Now, people may think they want bigger mass, but they tend to compensate for it with slower speed. So there is also a speed-mass ratio of tolerance. You can have a big mass if it goes awful slow. Therefore, you see the fellow in his Cadillac going 20 miles an hour on the turnpike, you know. You see this quite a bit. You know? Massive car, very tiny speeds. So on. The car would be totally undesirable to him, you see. The speed-mass ratio would be too high a figure if he drove that car at a proper speed, you see, 35, 40, 50, something like this. Ha ha, it's too much for him, man. Also, you get the popularity of small cars and the popularity of scooters, motorbikes, but not motorbikes that go fast, but scooters that go slow. You find those things are getting, they have a popularity. Well, they may or may not have a practicality. They do furnish transportation at very, very low petrol and gas cost. Remember something. You're actually increasing the liability of an impact. See, there's something going astray here because the percentage of accidents that occur on scooters, not condemning anybody's scooter, I just soon ride scooters. I preferably prefer TT model 650s, however. But, the deterioration of his idea of what mass is good mass actually puts him in danger. See? So it isn't reasonable. Sense and logic have nothing to do with this. It is simply the concept of how much mass is mass and how much is so on. And they will do stupid things. You wonder how stupid they can get. About 400 A.D., the Roman legions, because the armor was too heavy, had ceased to practice with practice armor, which was always heavier. And they had ceased to use practice armor of any kind. It was always heavier than battle armor, don't you think? Nobody could get them to practice with it anymore. And 50, 75 years later, we find these same legions going into battle having thrown away their armor. They're nuts. Okay. They no longer can strike an accurate blow, and here they don't even defend themselves, don't you see? So, frankly, what happens is their concept of the stronger, higher forces diminishes and disappears. It fades out. They no longer have any concept of these forces. These forces are beyond their concept. Well, similarly with pain, an individual readily forgets how much pain can hurt. You know, how much pain can pain be? You find accident victims very often are surprised as hell at how hard it hurts. See? Well, similarly, they just surprise the devil when that much mass occurs. That's too much mass. They get the idea. In other words, not only does the ability to experience it deteriorate, but the ability to conceive it deteriorates. So eventually they start doing stupid things. See, they're trying to avoid pain, so they get hurt all the time. Got your accident prone. They're no longer able to conceive the mass. They're no longer able to conceive the force. And they're always being surprised at the pain. And it doesn't last in their minds any time duration at all, so they get hurt again. And they get... And that sometimes these people will explain to you the chain of circumstances by which they were hurt. And man, it hasn't anything to do with what happened. You stand there with your jaw dropped. You've already made a leg up on this before you came to St. Hill, actually. Because all the time you've been in processing, your tolerance of mass and force has been increasing. And because you can wipe out pain in yourself with an assist, and you've had experiences of this particular kind, your respect for it and your awe of it is diminishing. Well, you're just climbing back up the scale. So I'm actually talking about something, a route you have been on for some time. Now, it'd be just a little bit difficult for you to immediately and directly then catch up with what the, quote, man in the street, unquote, has as a concept of pain, force, and mass. See? What does he think these things are? See? What is he willing to handle? What does he conceive of as actual force, actual mass? see. And so you see him going on doing silly, stupid things. And one of your biggest protests against the world around you is people are doing such stupid, silly things. They're doing very silly things. They do very silly things with force. They do very silly things with mass. You've got an instance right this moment, although I told Ron I wasn't going to say anything about the world situation. You've got this very moment, and have had for a dozen years or more, or more than that, 20 years, force which is totally beyond the concept of the world's greatest leaders. You have to say it reverently. But they don't know what they got their paws on. See? This you read with amazement how they compare nuclear fission to a 100,000-ton bomb of TNT or something, or 62 TNT bombs, or groping around, you see, within something that they can call a textbook, you see, response to World War II. What has anything to do with it? Because that force and mass is delivered in a split second. And because it is delivered in such a small moment of time, it has enormous impact value, which is upwards through millions of times the impact value of TNT. But, you know, not even in their textbooks have I seen them sort that fact out. They don't adequately sort it out. You see, actually, the force increases as the time decreases, because force is always measured in units of time. So if you have milliseconds of time in which a force is delivered, you see, you can't use force without a reference to time. Just that's, by definition, that's what force is. So the shorter the time period of the force delivery, why, the greater the impact. You see, the greater the actual force. I'm using very clumsy words because force does contain time, don't you think? You can't say the smaller amount of time in which that force is delivered, you'd have to say the foot-pounds are delivered. You deliver 1,000 foot-pounds. You deliver 1,000 foot-pounds in an hour, and all you are doing is driving uptown in your car. See? Something like that. You deliver it in 5 minutes, and you're probably pushing over a brick wall or something. You deliver it something on the order of a half a second, you're getting up around naval gunfire. Yes. Well, that's the same 1,000 foot-pounds, don't you see? So this distributed out over a period of time becomes confrontable. But as it is reduced in its period of time, becomes unconfrontable. And nuclear fission has done just that. There is no such thing as comparing it to 1,000 TNT bombs. Exploded at what frequency? How often? In what mass? Because they don't even go off as fast as nuclear fission. This is very interesting because they've just totally avoided this whole idea. So they don't know what to do with this. They haven't any idea what to do with all this force. Here's a head of state, and he has these tremendous forces and these tremendous striking powers and all that sort of thing. And he says, well, go shoot me some gnats. Do something like that with him. He doesn't know. He's groping, don't you think? The distribution of this force, what would happen to it? You find all sorts of arguments. They take a great pat on the back. They pat themselves on the back as realists. They say, well, it wouldn't crack Earth's crust. We exploded 1,000 of these things over Russia. It wouldn't do anything much. We hope. We guess. Well, I frankly believe that any time they start using this stuff in any great range or action and so forth, I firmly believe that it'd be just exactly like firing a shotgun with the breech half closed. the guy firing it is going to get just about as much as anything being shot at. You know, they're up there to a force that they can't live with having released. So that's why you have these brothers around conference tables discussing and arguing, and they're trying to play chess with this stuff, you know. You watch this, you know. Well, it isn't that these are great men that know what they're doing and guiding destinies all properly. It's just that they don't know what game they're in. See? This is going to surprise them. They're going to get a very great surprise. War usually surprises such people. You're wondering whether I think there will be a nuclear war in the next 5 minutes. Well, I'm not going on a vacation on the 2nd of November. I just looked at the old crystal ball, and it looked sort of explosive up there around the 12th or 13th, so I thought, well, I'll go later. Oh, I don't think they'll do anything very desperate. I'm just giving you an idea. These birds, the forces involved are actually sufficient and adequate, if they had any concept of what they're doing, to bring them at once to a conference table to arrange to disband the lot. You get the idea? Let's take it all. Now, let's put it in a hole someplace and make fuel out of it or something, and they just be pals, eh, about this whole thing, you know. No, they're playing games with it, you know. I'll shoot you if you shoot me, you know. God, that's crazy, you know. Because leader A fires at leader B, the same shot is going to take leader A's head off. Yeah, I often wonder if they don't think of themselves as the whole world in flames and the government building untouched. It's marvelous to behold, don't you see? That they're just dealing with greater force than they have any concept of. And they actually still want to play politics. Well, only a madman would do something like that. I had a good title a few years ago. I was going to write a book, The Madmen in Charge. Never got around to it, but still may do it. Sounds like it might be an interesting book. Washington, by the way, is its evacuation plans change every month or so. But apparently everybody in the Navy Department is supposed to go get their car in the parking lot and then drive past the entrance to the Navy Department. And then the people in the entrance to the Navy Department are supposed to come out of the entrance, and they're supposed to get in these cars. And then they're supposed to go to an area nearby. And then they're supposed to set up something there. I'm not quite sure. I think the plan fades out before they get to this new area. We're going to have a queue of 2,000 cars or 5,000 cars or 15,000 cars strung out in front of a single entrance. They just never make it, that's all. This deteriorated, these civil defense plans deteriorated to something very amusing. I think not too long ago, somebody from the civil defense headquarters in Washington, from writing books as to what we were supposed to do, I saw their last set of plans. It's very interesting. They move things from one section of town to another section of town compared to which section of town was damaged by the bombs. Yeah, and they're... The hospital where they're going to bring all the casualties to was in the middle of town. This is just insane raving, don't you think? I was very much amused at all this, but the denouement of this, having been issued many copies of this from time to time and changing plans and so forth, why, the last one I heard from FCDC is the civil defense officials had come around and called, I think it was on the org sec, and had asked him if we had any civil defense plans. Did we have any plans? He didn't want them for the town. Apparently the policy now is for every organization to have its own plans for civil defense. You get the deterioration into the total individuation of it all. See? Now everybody's supposed to have a separate set of plans. And man, that'll really look good.
You get around Washington, you know, some of the kids around Washington, they really laugh about this because they go out along the highways. And I think they've taken most of these signs down. I didn't see them when I was over there last month. I didn't see a one. Well, I wasn't looking very hard either. But they used to have signs, and you drive outside the District of Columbia in any direction, and it said in time of national emergency or something like this, this highway will be closed to civilian traffic. Only it was on all highways and on all roads, on all sides of the district. Marvelous. In other words, they cannot plan in the face of that much force, do you see? They become totally illogical in the face of that much force. There is no planning involved beyond their concept or ability. Telephone call this afternoon from the States. Somebody remarked that people are tearing around madly in all directions, buying supplies of food and digging holes in the ground, and they're having a ball. They're having a ball. I think probably the safest place in the world, probably Washington, D.C. Probably very safe. Because you see, if their level of confront is that poor, it's very doubtful if anybody will confront Washington or Moscow. Because these would be the two places you would have to confront to solve the situation. Well, I don't think the war will ever come up to confronting either place. I think we're in more danger. I think they will probably find out that it was England and South Africa that started the whole Cuban invasion. They'll get something figured out. Therefore, you are baffled very often at somebody's approach to his, quote, problems in life. What he will do as a solution to his problems. And how this sounds logical to this person, you don't dig. You listen to him. You hear words, but it doesn't make any sense. Well, let's see, if he just sends his wife, who is 40, to the university, and if he himself will take up skin diving, why, somehow his overdraft at the bank will all work out. Man, you'll hear some wild ones. Now, what's the matter with this guy? Well, his problems contain force. And he cannot confront either using or receiving that much force, so he simply neglects it. Now, it's this factor alone on which the governments of the world are constructed today, that people cannot conceive force. You realize if you break the law flagrantly in any large country, you realize that the entirety of the army, the navy, the air force, and the whole police, the entire judiciary, and through newspapers and so forth, public opinion, meaning the rest of the population, can be totally turned against a single individual. You realize it's rigged that way? Well, how could it possibly get rigged that way? It's because nobody conceives that it's rigged that way. They say, well, I have a power of vote, and I'm a free citizen. And you go on hearing these yap, yap, yaps. See? And then all of a sudden, this individual says, no, I won't pay any taxes. Well, man, they make short work out of that. Well, what if this individual got themselves a machine gun emplacement and sat down and spoke back in kind? What do you think would happen? Now, supposing he got two or three other means of defense and got a defense in depth and so forth, how much troops do you think would eventually be piled up against this individual before he finally surrendered? It would be the whole force of the country, wouldn't it? Well, every citizen in a country is versus the force of that country. This is not democracy. This is just blindness. Who ever got around to figuring out a form of government like that? There's no freedom involved. It's just an overwhelm. A total overwhelm. Ireland didn't quite buy this. Ireland had an interesting thing. and in its government, you can sue personally any individual in the government who does anything you don't like. Now, of course, that rather returns it to a democratic process. Cop gives you a parking ticket. Honest, he's just in trouble if he doesn't have witnesses, because he can't enforce the collection or the fining of that ticket if you contest it, because you could sue him for the full value of the fine if you won your case. You don't get a very militant police force this way. They're more angry than otherwise. But, all right, in Washington, this might theoretically apply, but in Washington, you should realize that about 75 warrants a week are requested of the federal district courts against government officials for non-constitutional and illegal acts in the performance of their duty. Just about 75 a week are requested by the public in that one area of Washington. And to date, the district court has never issued one. They simply refuse to issue. It just stops right there. They just blanketly refuse to issue those warrants. That means if a government official came in, pulled out a gun, killed everybody dead in the house — this is the knee plus ultra on the thing — and some relative wanted him indicted for murder, it wouldn't happen. That is the government of Russia today. So you see how governments deteriorate. That's not the government of the U.S. or England today, but it's the government of another country today. They do walk in and kill everybody in the house every now and then and drag somebody off to prison. Nobody ever hears of them again. And there's no recourse. Nobody can say a word. You have to, in England, the United States, we generally keep a propaganda fan going of some kind or another. It's just propaganda, it's just talk. Against the official. We back him down. We back him down. We always got to keep him more or less convinced that he hasn't got any rights. You got to keep snarling. You got to make him trouble. You got to do this, you got to do that. The English have got this down to a fine art. That's how you keep a government from finally caving in and falling all over you, you see, and dragging you off in the middle of the night. But the truth of the matter is there's absolutely nothing that restrains them from doing it except tradition. Rather thin stuff, tradition, isn't it? Yes, when I'm faced with machine guns and cannon and troops with fixed bayonets, there's nothing like having only tradition to hold my position, I always say. It's so thick, so protective. Every once in a while, though, you hear somebody getting a very satisfactory bang out of dying like a hero for his country on the gallows or for the people or something like that. I want to point something out to you. He died on the gallows. Cost him a body to make that remark. And at one body per remark, it gets expensive. Well, there I pointed out to you on upper dynamics the decline of force till force becomes invisible to the person. He doesn't recognize that the force is there. Well, as an individual goes on from the time of the goal through the rock area and the opposing masses, and he's terminals and he's faced with opterns, and all this gets crushed in, and the counter forces and that sort of thing, the whole thing eventually vanishes. He can't see any part of it anymore. He doesn't even know it's there. See, it doesn't exist. And you tell him to try to confront it, and he flinches. Well, it's interesting that he flinches from nothing. The modern psychologist can give you a very good example of this. He says there's no such thing as a mental image picture. Occasionally you'll run across in his text some mention of it. I ran across a mention of it one time, and he said children and morons sometimes have them. Yeah, it's fascinating. The man is below observing them. He's never observed them professionally until it's walked into his science, see, as a fact that they don't exist. I preserved carefully the last copy off the publishing company's line. It was the textbook on psychology for the University of Chicago, I think. And it moved off of the assembly bookbinding line as the first copy of Dianetics, the Modern Science of Mental Health, moved off that line. The last copy of that run was followed by the first copy of Dianetics, Modern Science of Mental Health. I picked the book off and said to the publisher, the binding was not well pressed or anything, and I picked the psychology textbook off. Actually, it was right on the assembly lines, on the belt, you know, and I picked it off and I said to the publisher, look, let me have this, will you? I said, because after this, they're going to be writing this book into their newer text, and I want to know what exactly psychology was. And he said, oh, yeah, well, you can have a copy of it, Ron. So I kept it, and I've still got it. It's rather fascinating, because in the last 12 years, they have taken different looks at things, and they have discovered all sorts of things, prenatal influences and that sort of thing. And they will discover more and more as time goes on. But what does it depend on, that series of discoveries? An improvement of their own ability to look. So you get them to confront a little bit more and a little bit more, and they can't confront what you can confront, but they can confront a little bit more, don't you see? Well, a gradient scale of confront is what you were up against in handling any PC toward clearing. And it isn't enough to just tell them, confront it and confront it and confront it and confront it and confront it. Because every now and then you tell him to confront it and something knocks his silly head off and he knows better next time. Because you pushed him into an area of too much force. Too much mass, too much force. It's getting too real to him and he backs out. So the study of clearing, now that one knows the mechanics of clearing and what the bank apparently contains and looks like, brings us to the realization, not to the startling new data, but it brings us to the realization that a gradient scale of confronting is the only way we ever clear anybody. The improvement of the ability of the PC to confront then becomes a very pertinent point in clearing. And that, too, cannot be done directly because you have to find out what he can confront. And fortunately, if you just asked him to confront and confront something more and confront something more, why, he theoretically, you see, would come up with his goal in the end and he would be clear and so forth. But let me point out to you, this has never happened and it's never likely to happen because there's already too much there for him to confront. See, he's already above the confront level. So this meter, or any variety of meter, gives you, this is what this meter does, oddly enough, that does, it's unsuspected by you unless you take a look at it. It gives you the highest, toughest confront that the PC is capable of at that given moment. And it's a measurement of confronting. So if it took you 10,000 hours on gradient scale of confronting to clear somebody, you wouldn't, but let's say that you did just ran some confront process for 10,000 hours, maybe you'd get clear. Who knows? This, to make clearing factual and fast within reason, so that you get it done now and then and once in a while, you've got to be able to pick up the highest level of confront that the individual is capable of repetitively. In other words, you've got to give him everything he can confront right now, and then everything he can confront right now, and then everything he can now confront right now. Got the idea? And his confronting has got to be beefed up and improved to that degree. And a meter selects out for you, the auditor, to find something the PC can confront. And oddly enough, this is just luck on our part, we have an instrument which leads us straight down this channel without any divergences by giving us the mostest he can confront now. Now the most he can confront now. Now the most he can confront now. See? And by these great big bites of increased confront, he gets over the idea that he can't confront. He actually would confront no more than you can find reading on the meter. He'd confront no more than you can find on a meter. If you can't find it on the meter, there are only two reasons why you can't find it on the meter. And the first reason is he can't confront it. The second reason could be that you just haven't found it. In other words, you didn't get anything on the meter, so of course he can't confront anything on the meter. Every once in a while, you'd be busily clearing somebody, and suddenly you'll see that thing go slam, 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 slam. You're running lines, see? And you'll see it go slam, 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 slam. And you sit there and utter the command. One of two things happened. Either the slam dwindles, or it vanishes. Now, if it dwindles, all right. If it just vanishes, you ask the PC, what'd you do? He says, oh, it's a little bit too hot for me. I'm sorry, I backed out of that. See, they didn't know what they were getting into, and it made them nervy. And they backed out. Now, that it doesn't mean that they won't go back there. It won't mean that your commands and so forth, just ordinary process of doing lines, won't bring them back into the channel again. Well, what is this slam, 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 slam you see on the meter? Actually, it is force hitting motionlessness. There's a motionlessness in the bank that is being impinged upon by forces. And the direction of flow back and forth and motion of particles in the vicinity of that motionlessness apparently is what gives you the phenomenon of a rock slam. In other words, it's something that's changing polarities at such great speed from plus to minus and back and forth and so forth, that it causes direction of potential changes and so forth. So the meter doesn't know what it's measuring, and it's measuring high, low, medium, high, low, medium, high, low, medium, see? And it goes... You could say that you're coming down the exact meeting points of the terminal and op-term. You're measuring their exact collision points. So that's where you'd have maximal force with minimal motion of the obstacles. So these things start flying apart when you start disturbing this balance of potential between the two of them, and you eventually get down below the rock, and you hear the rock go, kind of. I don't mean that, actually. The PC says something went, you know. Once in a while, a couple of pieces of something goes, and you get fooled. One dumbbell goes, well, that wasn't the rock, see? There'll be another one blow, and there'll be other things happen. He gets on down below, and he finally hits his goal, and bang, it goes clear, and it goes kind of pop, and there it was, and that was why I made up my mind, and gee whiz, give him a bit of a prep check, get rid of the fragments, and that's that, he's clear. You never do it without following him down the line on a meter, and you never do it without the maximal speed of improving his ability to confront. That has to be steep. As I say, if you just took it at a slow poke, you might be 10,000 hours in the process before you made it. But you hit it on the high line, you come right straight down the rock slam channel, it goes right on down to the rock and op rock, and you all of a sudden have got it the whole way, you're down to basic, that blows, the rest of it tends to fly apart, and that is that. You understand now why this is important, and what you're doing actually in clearing. Of course, I give you this mainly as a allegory and so forth, but actually that's a pretty accurate graphing of the way it is. Under that will lie another package and another GPM. Somebody said to me, why don't you run the assertion that goes just before the goal He didn't realize. He was saying, why don't you run the second goal you're going to find on the PC before you run the first goal you find on the PC? Why doesn't the second goal register? It can't. How can it? The guy's confront isn't up to seeing the first goal. Well, the second goal is just that much stronger and that much bigger. So you have to run the goals off by a gradient of confront, and you run down to these rocks by a gradient of confront. You understand that? So you got a whole series of these things, one after the other, of these whole maps of a GPM. And eventually when you get to that, you just raise the level of confront all out of proportion. That's why your PC gets to feeling better, why your PC looks better, so forth. Your PC is much more capable of confronting force, much more capable of withstanding pain, and much more capable of observing and conceiving mass. Okay? Thank you.